build your first flying chair.
Oh, you're talking about my autogyro.
Yeah.
I have loved airplanes ever since I was born, actually. In my picture album, some of my first pictures in the album is a little tiny, tiny kid is sitting on the wing of an airplane. And there's been something fascinating about flying all my life. So anyway, as far as building an airplane, I saw in, I think it was a Science and Mechanics magazine in 1950 or someplace in the 50s, a man by the name of Igor Benson had just invented a gyro glider. It's an autogyro that has no motor in it. You pull it like a glider.
And you pull it behind the car.
Pull it behind the car or something and pull it. Mm-hmm. And if you could pull it like 15 or 20 or 25 miles an hour, this helicopter-like rotor on top would auto-rotate above your head and actually provide lift like a wing of an airplane. And I fell in love with that. I couldn't wait to build one. And I couldn't afford to buy a kit. They were quite expensive right off the bat. So I used odds and ends and put one together anyway, out of whatever was I could lay my hands on.
But you had to buy special bolts and things that would withstand, didn't you tell me?
Yes.
Yeah.
For the next one.
Oh, the next one.
Now, this was the first one, John. The first one was made out of parts of the drive lines of automobiles, a water pipe. I used a set of lawnmower wheels and spliced together plywood for the rotor, the whole thing. Anyway, this one never flew. Thank goodness. But I learned a tremendous amount by building this first one. My dear wife, I don't know what I have put her through in her lifetime, but she was my co-pilot. This gallant little girl, 5'2", I asked her if she would tow me in this contraption. And she looked scared as all get out, but she said yes.
This was at the airport.
Yeah. We went out to a road right next to the airport. The road that is between the airport and the highway. And clear out to the sand pit out at the other end. And Gene started towing me. And I noticed as the rotors would speed up, and I was getting pretty close to flying speed, that suddenly something weird would happen. The rotors would suddenly stop, and then they would slowly start to rotate again. This went on two or three times before we got to the other end of the road, and I kept thinking, what in the world makes them stop? It makes kind of a whop when they stop, but I wasn't sure. So it's back to the drawing board. Got to find out why this thing stops. This would be embarrassing, you know, to be up 50 feet and have your rotor blades stop. So this had me worried. And so I come to find out there was a lot of aerodynamics that I hadn't thought of that they didn't show in the pictures in the magazine. So, being a little more sensible, I sent for a set of plans, and I got my first set of plans, and it showed me that these rotor blades needed a counterweight on the front leading edge to keep them from flapping. That is, they would suddenly provide so much lift on certain parts of the rotor blades that the rotor blade would twist up and hit the air completely flat sideways and stop it instantly. I was very lucky that they didn't just tear the rotor blades apart when it did this. But anyway, that was my first one. That was my first love. The second one, I ordered a set of rotor blades, a kit to make my own rotor blades. And I taught myself how to fly. Gene was my co-pilot. And the first time I lifted off, I flew almost the entire length of the road. It scared Gene and me both half to death because cars would keep passing us up on the road. When there's a car underneath you, you can't land. And I had a rough time finding the road. Every time I thought I was doing the controls right, I would end up over the bar pit or out over some cows at a terrifying angle on the rope. But we kept going that first time until I was over the road and I set it down, and Gene was at the exact end of the road. She couldn't have gone 1 foot farther. And now everybody that was out there to watch, they had to come and help me get my hands loose off the control. I had cramps in my hands and I couldn't get my hands to they were literally clamped.
When you landed with no room left on the road.
Yeah, that was scary. And my hands, you remember that T-bar, control T-bar? My hands I had been so nervous, I had, the muscles had spasmed to the point where I couldn't let loose. And boy, they were pulling on the fingers just to get my fingers loose out. I couldn't release them. And was I sore. And my stomach, and sore muscles, you know, you see. But anyway, that was the first one. And that was with the number two autogyro that flew. later on, by practice, I come to find out that it was extremely fun just to lift off. It required practically no effort. It took a little doing, you know, just to get to that point. And that was about the time we decided we need power instead of just towing it with the car. And so we added an engine to the autogyro. It was a pusher engine.
It was right behind the pilot,
right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It was a bolt, literally bolted onto the same mast that the seat was bolted onto. So you sat very close to the engine. It was very noisy, but very exciting. I remember taxiing faster. You can taxi very fast without taking off. It's when you decide, I'm going to take off, that it really gets scary. And the day came, I took off, and the autogyro kind of turned sideways, but still flew straight. That's weird characteristics of the autogyro. You can fly them almost sideways. And this was a new experience for me, because airplanes don't do that very well. And anyway, I had taught myself how to fly. They highly recommend people not to teach themselves to fly. Most of them don't survive this process. But anyway, I taught myself to fly. And I later found out that I was number 47 in the United States to fly one of these machines. Today, the last time I heard, there's over 20,000 of them flying. And they have them all over the world. It's a fun machine to fly. I see quite often there's a pair of them flies between LeGrand and Baker quite often. And so this was quite an experience. But I got a personal letter from Igor Benson with congratulations and a little write-up that he did. And I thought that I treasure that. But I don't know what it is that makes a person love the flying process. Either you love to fly, or it has no appeal whatsoever. There doesn't seem to be any in between. Everyone that flies knows that there's danger involved. But the thrill that you get just hovering through the air or being disconnected from the ground way outweighs that fear that you have that something's going to happen. It must be something that, or the fact that the people who fly are crazy in the head to begin with. I don't know which it is.
Then you decided you're going to build a regular airplane.
Uh-huh.
And you've been working on that in the basement until recently, or what?
Yes. I am approaching 78 years old, and I'm still playing with airplanes. This one is an ultralight. It's called the Skypup. It's a 32-foot wingspan. It flies with 22 horsepower. And everything has been manufactured right here, including the propeller. Everything except the engine.
Did you have a plan for it?
Yes. I got a set of plans for this. Mm-hmm. And I followed the plans up to the point of I built a better landing gear. The original landing gear was very simple with no shock absorbing capability. This one has full aircraft shock. So we're kind of anxious to see what it'll do. I might not live longer than maybe 78, but...
You said you recently tried it out and you found out something about the fuel line. What was it?
We took it out and did some high-speed runs out of the airport. We found that because we're using what they call a two-stroke engine, that is an engine that you mix oil with the gas, that you always have a little oil that comes out the exhaust. We've used a flexible exhaust pipe from the engine to the muffler, and this flexible pipe was right in front of the windshield. Consequently, this oil would leak through the flexes in the pipe and very quickly completely made the windshield so cluttered with oil and dirt we couldn't see, so we decided we've got to make a few changes here. There are a few things that can spoil your whole day if you're up there flying. Another thing was the brakes was too tight, which has a tendency to make a tail dragger, they call it. Want to stand on its nose. That's another thing that's terribly embarrassing. My instruments was too close to my to my face, really. It was 6 inches away above my head, and that's too close, so they're going to be there. But other than that, like, the thing flies fine.
You'll improve it.
Yeah.
You'll improve. Well, when you were in the Army, before you came to LeGrand, What did you do in the Army, Jack?
I worked with radar. They put me through radio school, and I qualified for a very secret process in the Air Force called radar. This was at the time a secret part of the airport, and so we were not called radar technicians, we were called signal corpsmen. We belonged to the signal corps, you know, waving flags and whatnot, and climbing poles and fixing telephone lines. They issued us pole climbers and a set of instruments to check out field phones and things, which I have to this day not the foggiest idea of how to work them. You're not going to catch me climbing one of those splintery poles. But anyway, we were told that we were never to mention the word radar. We were always flag wavers. And so everything was kind of hush-hush all the way through. It wasn't until the war was over that we found out just how secret this was and why all these camouflages and stuff that we used. But radar is a device that the English people had devised, and what it amounted to was sending out pulses of radio frequency energy, very fast and in short pulses, and receiving an echo from objects in front of you. And these radio signals could be bounced off of clouds, aircraft, ships, no matter mountains, no matter what. So it was quite it was a curious device for us, because we'd never heard of anything like this before. But here in a total fog or a total cloud cover, we could see objects miles away. And if you were out there looking for an enemy, why, you could see your enemy, but he couldn't see you. It was really one of the things that helped win the war, I thought.
Where did you serve?
Only in the United States. I never got out of the United States.
You went in the Army when?
1942, mm-hmm. And I got out, 1945? Mm-hmm. Something like this. What we did, we had the English instructors, the technicians from England, they would come over and they would teach us for a month, and then we would go out and work with radar and teach operators how to operate it. And by this time, there was new versions of radar that came out. So back to school, work on the equipment, then back and teach somebody what we had learned. And this is what we did all the way through the war. So we did, we ended up with radar that was quite compact and packaged. But because they hadn't invented the transistor yet, that was yet to come in the future, then we were still using hundreds of tubes, and the equipment was very heavy. And it's been interesting to see the era of the tubes all of a sudden die and disappear, and a brand new gadget come out. I remember hearing on the radio when the very first transistor was made, and I thought, that's got to be a joke. They're producing as much with a solid-state gadget and a good old tube, and I was a little bit envious, you know. Here they were kind of ridiculing the thing that I had idolized all my life, my electron tube. But after the war, and this happened maybe, let's see, about 1985 or 6, I had the extreme good fortune of talking to the one of the three people that invented the transistor. His name was Shockley. And Mr. Shockley and two others were the three people that had invented the transistor. And I met him by accident. I was actually laying some, or doing some pointing, some brickwork downtown. And this man across the street, he saw me, and he kept walking back and forth. And finally he came across the street, and he wanted to know what a good mix for putting rocks on a wall. And we kept talking, and in the conversation, he mentioned his name. Mr. Shockley, and that name kind of stuck with me. You wouldn't be, and he got a big smile on his face, and he said, yeah, I won't hide it from him. And so I closed shop, and we sat down and talked the rest of the afternoon. And I treasure that afternoon talk with one of the three people that have made television, computers, the world a different place in history. And that was a very treasured time for me.
It's interesting you'd show up in LeGrand.
Yes, and across the street, right? Yeah. I was like, evidently he had a relation or something. Oh.
Another question I was going to ask you about, you mentioned the mixture of brick. For so many years, the buildings downtown were built with lime and sand. When did they start putting cement in it? And it made quite a lot of difference in holding the building together, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Cement and lime have been used for thousands of years. It used to be that the mason himself would go out and find limestone. Limestone, marble is limestone. There are different types of sedimentary deposits that are limestone. It's a calcium carbonate. That's limestone. And if you take calcium carbonate and heat it red hot, it becomes calcium oxide. And that's years ago was called hot lime. Mm-hmm. Now if you mix calcium oxide with water, it becomes calcium hydroxide, which is a cousin to lye, sodium hydroxide. But anyway, when they would use calcium hydroxide and sand and water to lay up the mortar, then after long periods of time, like maybe 50 or so years, why the calcium hydroxide would absorb the carbon dioxide in the air and become calcium carbonate again, which is limestone. In the process, though, they find that the constant freezing and thawing, the mortar disintegrates. And there are different things in the atmosphere that break, just lime and sand break it down. So about 1940 or 1950, buildings start they started experimenting with by adding a little bit of Portland cement with this lime mixture, and they found that it really bonded the bricks together. The bricks are now, they don't just sit there on a pile of sand after years and years and years. They're still bonded. And that happened in our time, about 1950. I noticed that a lot of the masons would still use lime and sand, but they were converting to cement too. But as I said before, it used to be that masonry has gone on back as far as history, that they have used clay products and even burned clay products. They couldn't melt them or bake them as hard as they do now, but the bricklayer, he would also find a deposit of limestone. And you'd find that wherever, in almost every city, you'd find a clay deposit of some sort, and also a limestone deposit. And the mason would actually build a lime kiln, and you find them here and there. I've still found them alongside of a mountain here and there, where they found little limestone. They put them in here, heat them up red hot, and then they take this hot lime now and take it out to the job, and when they're ready to use it, they pour water on it, and it cooks and boils and steams like crazy. And it makes one of the beautiful mortar. And it's an old, old, old process.
Well, now with mixing mortar like that, what is the mixture for laying brick? With cement, Portland cement, lime, and sand?
We tried to use as much sand as possible because it's the cheapest. But we don't want to use too much cement and lime either, because then the sand grains aren't really touching. They're spread apart, and as the lime and cement dries, it shrinks and it will crack loose from the brick. So if you use it too rich, it will bond for a few hours, and then as it dries, it will break and break the bond. And so they have found that one of the best mixes that they can use is perhaps like three parts of sand to one part lime, and possibly up to one part of cement. One part of cement makes it a little bit more plastic. It's best if you use less than that. One part of cement will make it easy to use, and it'll cure without question.
Bricks are more or less the same size all over the country in the finished product.